Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Ohel David and Shlomo Torah Israel's Sephardic Congregation of Manhattan Beach. Someone asked me if tonight is a special occasion, and I said yes, it's a special occasion, because we have an opportunity once again to invite you to share in an evening that you will enjoy, that you will learn, you will advance in knowledge. And we have the privilege of having with us a scholar, a gentleman, and someone who is well-versed in Jewish knowledge. Dr. Shiffman, Professor Shiffman, has been involved in the study and research on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but there's a lot more than that. And, of course, you will hear directly from him concerning this. The topic is community. Community then, community now. And without any further ado, I introduce to you, I present Professor Shiffman.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to see a variety of old friends and new friends, including some old friends and that I didn't realize where they were or what they, you know, how they were connected, and some former students and almost current students by, I guess, some current students and some former students by a couple of weeks, I guess one could say, now that the semester has ended. Now let me begin by saying, as a way of a sort of admission, that I got sort of lucky when this topic was suggested. This is not a standard topic that people are interested in and that I usually talk about, but years and years ago, regarding the earlier part of this question of the nature of Jewish community, its conceptual and historical basis, I was asked to speak at a conference which was held at one of the Y's in New Jersey, and which was supposed to result in a volume, which didn't. And I went on eventually to publish some of this material in a publication in Australia. So that in the end, it's a subject that I have given some thought to. But having said that, I have to tell you that it took considerable work to figure out how best to approach this question. Because the platitudes are easy, and any one of you could get up and talk about Jewish community, say things which I'm sure are correct, perhaps even interesting, and you wouldn't have needed me for that. So what I'm going to do is to try to present to you a combination of a conceptual and historical account that I hope can be the basis for some of the decisions that we face as Jewish community today, in general, and also in our specific groups. Now, I should tell you right off the bat that this term community is very problematical. Actually, if you look up in encyclopedias of religion and sociology, you'll see that there are a lot of questions about what it means. And let me say right off the bat that there's a very interesting fact about the Jewish community and the word community. The word community seems to mean all the Jews, like you would think that there would be such a thing as the American Jewish community. In fact, we use this term sometimes as a collective for a variety of sub-communities, which is why there are certain communities in which the word community may in fact refer only to themselves. For example, somebody might say, in our community we eat sweet gefilte fish. Now, what they mean is that they're a group of Jews that come from a certain place in Europe. They don't mean the Jewish community. Community is a sub-community within the Jewish community. And then there is another problem, which is closely related, which is that the term community is sometimes used in ways in the Jewish community that are simply false. For example, an event in the community, in quotes, that has 14 synagogues, which is sponsored by two, which is called the Community X. Now what they really mean is we and our friends down the block held an activity together. But they have some form of overblown view of themselves, as if they constitute not a community, but the community. And this is typical in Jewish usage because, in fact, the Jewish community term really speaks about something else, which is an overlapping set of communities that we all are part of. Now what that means is there's something called the Jewish community, which has all kinds of Jews, many Jews that are very far from the people in this room. Then there is something called the Jewish community, or maybe you might say the Orthodox community. And then there are a variety of things within the community that may refer to sub-communities of which different people may belong. The Jews from place A, B, or C. Or perhaps the Jews who use this, that, or the other prayer book. And then there may be individuals who therefore belong to several communities. So when we say community in general, we don't really mean community, we mean society. And the society is made up of sub-communities. Now this may seem like a waste of time, what I just told you. But it's actually not. Because what we're going to see is that a variety of the ways in which the Jewish community functions to keep us Jewish do not necessarily apply to the entire community. And one of the fundamental questions that we have to ask ourselves all the time as Jews is to what extent are we served well by focusing on the overall community, which, whatever that means, or focusing on subgroups within the community, or even more interestingly, subgroups within subgroups. Now, in terms of the theological side of Jewish community, we should point out a few very important issues that arise from Jewish thought. First of all, one of the things about the Jewish community is that it cannot be separated from history. This is made clear by Yehuda Levi in the Kuzari, when the Khazar king finally gets to speak to the so-called Chaver, the rabbi, and the rabbi starts to give his response about what Judaism is all about. He starts talking about what is essentially history. There is a link between history and community which cannot be broken. It's obviously true about subgroups within the community. So if you use terms like the survivor community, the obvious fact that these people were part of a historical event and process that the rest of us were not is obvious. The second aspect of community, which is very essential, is a point that was made by Rav Soloveitchik at great, great length. And I know that there are certain places in the Orthodox community that you can't have a speech if you don't quote Rav Soloveitchik. But I'm not quoting it for that reason. I'm quoting it because it seriously is relevant. And that is to say that his point of view about the covenantal community is essential. Now, he derives the covenantal community from Adam and Eve together with God. And that's okay for homiletical purposes. But vis-a-vis the Jewish community as a whole, the covenantal community comes into being at Sinai. Because at Sinai, the entire Jewish people enter into a covenant with God. And now here's another really interesting thing. To some extent, with one another. There are certain aspects of the covenant with God which bind Jews one to another. Obviously, mitzvot bein adam l'chaveiro, the commandments between one person and another. Or mitzvot bein adam l'makom. Let's remember that there is really, on some level, no commandment between one of us and the next person, which is not also a commandment between one of us and God. And Rav Soloveitchik makes use of the relationship of Adam and Eve in order to demonstrate this point. And this, of course, is the well-known, in certain sense, quotation of the Gemara, when the Gemara says that there are three partners in a person, the Father, Mother, and God, the Holy One, blessed be He. What it's saying is that marriage is a form of a covenantal community. That's the homiletics. But the historical reality is that the Jewish people at Sinai constructed a covenantal community. So on some level, that is the community when you start to speak about Jewish community. Now, there are a lot of halachic perspectives. For example, in halachic perspectives, the minyan seems to constitute the Jewish community. Now, if you have a minyan, others, which usually means women and children, who join in the minyan are considered to be part of this collective, even if they themselves wouldn't count to create the collective. Now, the collective requires 10 males. One could go into all kinds of explanations about why it should require 10 males. It's actually not our topic this evening, so I can pass over it and simply tell you the following. That once we know that you need 10 males, what happens to these 10 males is that somehow, when they are there, this group symbolizes the whole Jewish people. And now you could say to me, well, what are you talking about? If in this synagogue over here there are 10 males and they're the whole Jewish people, down the block there's another 10 males and they're the whole Jewish people, how could they both be the whole Jewish people? Well, that's how it works. Because they still are symbolic and representative of the entire Jewish people, and therefore anything done before a minion is considered. So that there's a level on which the community can be seen as this. There's this whole covenantal community of all Jews, and then there's a way in which it can break up so that each minion is as if it's a whole community. Now, if you don't believe me, you just have to look at the arguments that took place in the Mishnah about the problem of how to say the Borchu and Nivareich, depending on how many people are joining in a quorum, and why it is that between originally the Mishnah wanted to suggest different numbers from 10 and up. And depending on how many people were there, you would have different increasing numbers. This was eventually rejected in the halachic debate, because once you have 10, it's as if you have everybody. And it doesn't make a difference how many more you have. Now, another set of subgroups within the community, it's Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael. Now, this is where we break up the community, in quotes, into groups of people which are broken up because of function based on a particular form of holiness. Now, this means already that a person can be part of the subgroup of Kohanim and Leviim, let's forget Yisrael, the rest of us, because that's sort of like everybody, right? But they can be broken up into a subgroup within the community without losing their status in the community, because they have a core role in the community. Now, from a historical point of view, you could say that on some level, these are the first forms of authority within the community, but we'll be coming back to that. Another area that works within halakha regarding division of the community is what we might call, in American lingo, ethnic groups within the population. Now, here we'll come back a little bit later to the question of why somebody might want to maintain such a group. Who cares if you come from this place or the other place? However, what I want to address now is something else, which is the halakhic basis for maintaining the identity of such groups, which has changed radically throughout the years. If you look at the medieval poskim, which are really the first place where you talk about what happens if a Jew goes from one country to another, the bottom line is that if I would move tomorrow to Iran in the Middle Ages, besides trying to learn Farsi, which is pretty hard, I should start using the Siddur of the Persian Jews. And I should start adopting all of their customs, assuming I don't intend to come back. Why? Because I am an individual. What happens if 5,000 of us decide to go? And 5,000 Ashkenazim from America decide to move to Iran tomorrow. In the medieval approach, we should eliminate our earlier customs and accept the local customs and follow them. This gets eliminated in modern times because there is a notion of maintaining your group in a foreign place with its customs. Now, here's the really curious fact. The Jewish community becomes a melting pot in America and Israel. And therefore, it becomes a halachic melting pot. Because if each group now is going to maintain its own customs as if it was the first Jews to arrive there, and not accept the customs of those who are already there, then that would seem to be that all the groups are being split up. And yet, today, more than any other time in Jewish history, maybe not more than, maybe it's the only time, you find, especially in Israel, synagogues where nobody cares where the people come from and what sinner they're going to use, and the chazan can go up and say whatever he wants and nobody minds. This all is a major halakhic change which is relevant to what we're talking about tonight. Because what has happened is that the notion of permanent ethnic groups within the population, found already in the Cairo Geniza, where you had so-called Palestinians and Babylonians, we're going to return to this because we're going to do a sort of a historical survey after this conceptual one. Part A is conceptual and halachic, and part B is going to be historical. So what has happened is that in the modern period, the notion that you keep your group and you keep its customs no matter where you go, so that you could theorize my 5,000 Ashkenazim moving to Tehran, besides having to do something about the president over there, right, would be immediately in our system, would organize Ashkenazic synagogues. All of which, of course, is not what would have been done in the Middle Ages, when there was no difference between an individual moving and a large community moving. Now, when was the breaking point? The breaking point was probably the expulsion from Spain and the emigration from Spain, which led to the exportation of Spanish, in quotes, Judaism to all kinds of places on the north and south of the Mediterranean. But this represents a different approach to community and sub-community in modern times. tribes than existed before. Now, another sort of part of this conceptual theory is to ask some questions about why we have a Jewish community. Because, like, why do we need it? What do we mean by this? And I think if you look at this, you'll see why my overlapping communities view is really correct. Let me just go quickly through some things that are obvious to you. First of all, the Jewish community is a vehicle for continuity. By the way, one obvious point. The Jewish community should always make its decisions in light of the criteria that I'm giving or ones like it, as opposed to, who knows what, just survival. We think that the Jews that came from Afghanistan should stay Jews from say that came from Afghanistan, no matter what. Well, wait a second. What if staying an Afghani Jew means that you'll be lost in America and end up unaffiliated? In other words, the question always has to be asked how the notion of community and subcommunity, how it serves the overall purposes, which are these now. Vehicle for Jewish continuity, Jewish education, social welfare, facing the anti-Semitic climate, which is the job of the modern defense organizations that we have. The issues here essentially all refer to ensuring the future, to advancing Torah commandments, Jewish commitment, Jewish observance. So that is an overall set of what we might call social and political needs for which we have a community, and we'll see this throughout the ages in a few minutes, which always must remain the goal of Jewish communities or sub-communities. Now, let me mention here something that's going to come up in our historical discussion all over the place. The difference between Israel and Galut. Obviously, in Galut, the Jewish community is a minority community in a larger society. In America, it's a free one. If you happen to belong to the dwindling Jewish community of Egypt, free or not free, I think you will be having a very different experience from American Jewry. And the answer to this is obvious why. Or, however, to give another example, a Jewish community in a free country with a strange history is Germany, where today we have a booming Jewish community. Nobody would have ever expected this. 80 to 100,000, I'm not sure what the number is, but it's clearly, once again, becoming a major Jewish community. And it's obvious that we have to realize that even within the Galut, the notion of being a minority, even in a free country, is very different. But of course, we all went through the experience of watching the Soviet Jews, a massive community of Jews who are a minority in an unfree society. And of course, all of this conflicts greatly with what it means to be a Jewish community in a Jewish state, where effectively the state is the community. And many of the roles that are normally followed, provided by the community, like this education and social welfare, all this kind of stuff, are now provided by a state, which is essentially a modern national state. Now, a few other points to just mention, that one of the themes that I'm going to follow in the historical survey, besides everything we mentioned before, is I'm going to follow the Ashkenaz-Sfarad division. Now, let's just mention, I think everybody knows this, both of these terms are misleading. The Ashkenazi Jews are not from Germany. Anyhow, Ashkenaz probably originally wasn't Germany. Sfarad was not originally Spain. The so-called Sephardic Jews are not from Spain. However, the other terms that we would use are not going to do very well. Anyhow, European Jews, but most Jews in America were never in Europe, or at least weren't born in Europe. And Sephardic, of course, is misleading because it implies that the people came from Spain, which, of course, most of them did not. Eidot HaMizrach is misleading because it takes out Spanish Jews and other types of Jews from places that are not supposedly in the Mizrach. And so there is no good term, so we have to stick with the term that we're going to use, bad or whatever as it may be. Now, with this introduction of understanding that there really are a variety of interlocking ideas, I want to address some of those things which in different periods were significant to the Jewish community and for which reason community or communities exist. What I'm after is, what are the modes through which the Jews sought to maintain the community, and through which the community sought to maintain all of these classifications that I gave before? So let's now start the biblical period. So now, one of the first essential questions of a community is self-definition. Who's in and who's not in? And we encounter very early in the Bible, and in fact it's present in every single period up till today, the question which we generally call, who is a Jew? Now, the who is a Jew question is observable even before it is addressed as such. In fact, it is not addressed as such until the Second Temple period. But here's a very interesting fact. In the early biblical accounts, we find that there are certain nations, the Canaanite nations, that Jews are forbidden to marry. In the book of Malachim, Kings, in the books of Malachim, we find that that list has been modified because different people are living around the Jews to include the new peoples. And finally, at the end, in Ezra and Nehemiah, we have the full discussion of the problem of intermarriage, and it's very clear that intermarriage is fully prohibited. And even I have argued that already it's clear that definition is by the mother and not by the father. But the point that I want to make here is that the notion of defining who is in and who is out of the community is an essential to a Jewish community. However, it's in tension with the notion of Jews in their own land. Because when you are in your own land, in the First Temple period, and by the way, the truth be told, even in modern times, it may be less important exactly who is in and who is out. And this is why we see that in Israel today, there are all kinds of leniencies, despite what you might get the impression of reading the media, in the who is a Jew issue, although they may start to be eliminated. But there have been all kinds of leniencies on the assumption that people are living in a Jewish land. Hence, for example, there have been conversion certificates that say valid only in Israel. I don't know what this exactly means. The person goes abroad, and we can jokingly assume the following problem. The person is in the kitchen, and they're preparing meat there, and this person takes the wrapper off the meat, helping, let's say, their sister-in-law. And then somebody comes in and says, this is a piece of kosher meat. And then we have a big problem, because the certificate of conversion is only valid in Israel. And the person who took the wrapper off is now not Jewish, because they left Israel. So this is pretty funny, this kind of stuff. I mean, who's getting whom? But the point of the matter is that what is underneath all this is a feeling that in Israel, Jewish identity is easier to preserve. And that is already in the biblical period, which is why it seems like you could join the people just by coming in there. Now, already in the Bible, we have the division into tribal and family units. Tribal and family units were a big part of identity. Of course, after the exile, there's no more tribal unit. Only the Kohen Levi Yisrael thing exists, which remains a part of the identity of Jews. But there is no more tribal, but the tribal was there in First Temple. Regional. Notice, by the way, you notice what's going on here. Everything we have now was already then. Regional. The North and the South have somewhat different identities. Now, that's analogous to what happened when Jews spread throughout the world. You know, like Litvox and Galicianers and all this kind of stuff, right? I was in Italy and I see that the sweet kind of Manischewitz type wine there, kosher wine, they call it Galicianer wine. I don't know if that would sell in America. Okay, however, the point is that the regional differences are extensive in the period of the First Temple. And we see them, later on we see them in the Mishnah period for Judah, Judea, and the Galilee. Then there's government. When the Jews were in their land, government was a big part of Jewish community. So first of all, you have what I want to call nomocracy. Nomocracy is not really government. Nomocracy means the rule of the Torah. Now, the rule of the Torah means the following. It doesn't matter who the government is. It doesn't matter what the government says. You're obligated to live according to the Torah. That is a basic of all Jewish community. It's the covenantal community. It's obvious to you. But I want to point out to you that since in the Torah, much of what the government does, as by the way, in modern times in Israel, is not in accord with Torah law. It provides an alternative source of authority that binds Jews to one to another, even though it may put them in actual conflict sometimes with the government. Then we have the tribal leaders and judges, who in the Bible we find are the lowest level of government. But below this even, there's the family and the tribe that we talked about before. But then, above all, this is a monarchy. Now, how does the monarchy work vis-a-vis the community? It seems that the monarchy is the ruler over all the sub-communities that are organized by family, tribe, when the community was unified, when the whole North and South were unified, before, you know, during the time of Shaul, David, and Shlomo. So during that period, it seems that the monarchy unified all the communities. During the later period, the monarchy could not unify the communities. But by definition, this monarchy did not follow what we normally call the law of the Torah. This is a point made by all the commentaries on the law of the king in Devarim and the story in Shmuel about Shmuel discouraging a king. So in all these different ways, the government and various type of leaders create communal groups because they are in charge of them. Now, as I said, we're overlapping communities. You could say our community then was grouped around the government and the boundaries of the country, etc. But what about another way of organizing the Jewish community, which is religion? Originally the tabernacle, which brought everyone together. Then we have a dissipation of community in the high places, the bamot. Then we have the destruction of the bamot and the recreation of community. And then we have the split of the north from the south, which creates an alternative place of worship. Again, dissipation of community. Then the principal center for religious community is destroyed. And again, community is dissipated. Now, we'll see later on, it gets rebuilt. Now, another principle still in the biblical period is the whole question of community groups around charity. Now, this may seem to you, it's kind of funny because, you know, in modern times, we have the idea that much of the Jewish community is organized around philanthropy, and that that's the organizing principle of the Jewish community, according to most theoreticians of American Judaism. That basically it's the UJA and the Federation and all that, which are the thing that holds the Jewish community together. In fact, if you look at biblical times, institutions of charity were a major, major part of the community. And one of the things you'll notice over and over again is that the poor are considered part of the community. And the reason you have to discharge your obligations to them is that they're part of the community required by the economy. Rightly or wrongly, the Torah assumes that a capitalistic economy will produce some poor people. They're part of your community. So therefore, because you benefited at their expense, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to be part of the non-poor, I don't want to say the rich, the non-poor, then what happens is that you therefore have an obligation in your community. In other words, the obligations of charity are directed to your own community. They're a unifier of the community and another element of obligation. Now, once we enter into the Persian period, the early Second Temple period, there's a new type of government, which is the Kohanim ruling over the people. And there is where a subgroup within the community, admittedly a subgroup because of their holiness, now gets switched over to government. There's a lot to be discussed about this mixing of priesthood and government. It's an ongoing debate within Jewish tradition all the time. But let us just say, for our point of view, that there comes a period after the return of the Jews in 520 BCE or so, and occupying a lot of the Second Temple period, in which the fundamental principle for the organization of the Jewish community is to be led by Kohanim, which therefore has behind it another fundamental assumption that the Jewish community is fundamentally about religion, and that that is the organizing principle rather than about independent government. Now, when we enter into the Second Temple period, so we're back into the land of Israel, we have a number of periods in our history. The Hasmonean rulers after the Maccabean revolt, the Roman procurators, the Herodians. Now we have something very interesting. The Hasmoneans, we have the government is equal to the Jewish community, etc. And notice that who's in and out of the community is who's in and out of the country. Because the Hasmoneans go out and attack idolaters who live in the country and try to rid the country of idolaters. But under the Roman procurators, and even under the Herodians, where Herod was a sort of Jewish king, the fact of the matter is that the Jews are under Roman rule, and we have a situation in which you have the Jewish community almost functioning like a minority in their own country. This is a particular situation of the Jewish community in the land of Israel during the period of Roman rule, where it's quite interesting, because the majority of the people are Jews, but they operate as a minority under a foreign ruler. Now here you have the temple as the religious center. You have large amounts of power given to Kohanim and Leviim. There are no tribes organizing the community. And the priests, even when they're the henchmen of the Romans, like Pontius Pilate, for example, are functioning as the inner Jewish government. Now, in this situation, we have some major, major shifts in the structure of Jewish community going on. First of all, we have the rise of the synagogue. where the synagogue during this period before the destruction for say 100 years or maybe 200 or 300 years earlier in the diaspora, and then in the land of Israel again from about the first century on, the synagogue begins to become the major institution of local Jewish community. That is a piece of heritage that is with us until today for the segments of the Jewish community for whom religion is significant. Doesn't matter what movement they are, it's true for the Reform, Conservative, not just the Orthodox. The synagogue becomes the center of the Jewish community. This is a big fight going on today in which the federations are sort of focused against the synagogue as an alternative center for Jewish community. But for certainly from late second temple times on, and whether it's in the land of Israel or Babylonia, the synagogue becomes the center. It arrogates to itself a whole bunch of other roles. Education, often the Beit HaSefer, that is the elementary school, was in the synagogue. Eventually, rabbinic leaders at least preach there. It takes itself also what you might call adult education. Charity becomes synagogue center. So the synagogue starts to become, in this period, a major area of the community. We also have the rise of the Pharisaic courts, the Pharisees being the forerunner of the rabbis, and the houses of study, institutions that will be with us, the Beit Din and the Beit Midrash, forever, as central avenues of community, which, however, I think if you check carefully, you'll see, constitute overlapping communities or overlapping agencies of community with other agencies. Now, while all this is going on, there's another, what I talked about right now, temple, synagogue, Tasmanians, the Herodians, all these people dealing with the whole Jewish community. And the same is the case with the Pharisees when they come with the message of the synagogue and Torah learning and all this. It's aimed at everybody. But there's another mechanism which we even have with us a little bit today. And this is the mechanism of sectarianism or individual movements. So if we take a look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, we'll see they have their own admissions. Now, I'm not looking at it to understand the Dead Sea Scrolls right now, because I'm assuming that there were other groups like the Dead Sea Scrolls group. The inner circle of the Pharisees called the Chaverim, who practiced all kind of legal stringency. And other groups like this, there was something called Kala Kadisha Dirushlem, this holy congregation of Jerusalem. There are all kinds of groups floating around. The Essenes of Philo and Josephus, the Therapeutae of Philo, some kind of other group like this. They all have the following features. There are admissions rules. There is a council. There's very strict purity laws. They have their own courts by which to try their members. They collect charity for their members. They have some kind of a leader, like the teacher of righteousness at Qumran. And they are in conflict with other groups, and they regard everybody else as non-kosher. Which is typical of many Jews, but that's how they think. Now, one could start with the whole definition of the Jewish community, is that it has to do with saying, you start with the community, and then you slice it up and say, these guys are fanatics, these guys aren't really good Jews. And one could define a whole Jewish community that way. Unfortunately, many people do. But here's the point I want to make. This sectarian approach that starts in Second Temple times, we might think that sectarianism is not the way to organize a Jewish community, but it's been with us from then until today. Now, some sects are open and want to let everyone in or interact. But fundamentally, many sectarian groups, if you want to call it that, are not. And a sect by definition, and we don't always use the term this way, but a sect by definition is a group that has split off from a so-called mainstream, which the sociologists call a church. Now, in the rest of late antiquity, we find the Jewish community split into Israel and Babylonia. And I said I was going to carry along this Ashkenazic-Sephardic distinction, because the truth be told, much of Ashkenazic tradition derives from the land of Israel, taken through southern Italy and up into Germany. And much of Sephardic tradition derives, certainly the real Sephardic with a capital S, from Babylonian traditions that are then taken across to Spain. And this approach, and then, you know, disseminated from Spain through the north and south of the Mediterranean. Now, this approach means that the split of the land of Israel and Babylonia in Talmudic times, and of course you all know the Babylonian Jewish community came about through 722, Assyrian exile, 586 BCE, Babylonian exile. These communities that are very, very ancient, these are essentially the origins of this split, even though it's more complex.
But now what's interesting is that in both of these communities, you find very parallel developments based on taking what they had when the Jews controlled their land and moving it to Israel where they don't control, and Babylonia where they don't control. So we have the Nasi, the patriarch, with his court, his rulers in the land of Israel, and we have the exilarch in the, we're talking about now, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, right? We have the exilarch in Babylonia. Both of them have the same issues. Now we have something new. We have internal Jewish government, where the internal Jewish government has to deal with the non-Jews. Recognize that? That's called the Conference of Presidents of American Jewish Organizations. It has not gone away, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. It has not gone away until today. Then we have the rabbinic courts. In this period, the rabbinic courts move into formal organization. It's no longer, like it says in the Mishnah, this guy gets one court, one judge, and the other guy gets one judge, and two judges choose the third judge. Forget it. The rabbinic courts are organized in a certain way. People receive appointments, they receive ordinations. This guy's here, this guy's here. Court system all over the place. Now, it's all different because, in one case, it's the Byzantine Roman Empire, which becomes anti-Semitic Christian from 325, and by 424, the Patriarchate has been closed down. However, in the Babylonian side, that didn't happen, and it continues to flourish. Now, here we find all of the aspects we talked about before. In the land of Israel, compulsory public education, that is to say, the community must provide education. Then we find various charity requirements. And, of course, we find the synagogue spread all over as a fundamental institution along with the Beit Midrash. And we have the notion of the rabbi coming to the fore. Originally the Talmudic rabbi. This is a function that will become part of the community, although it changes. Starting at the beginning as someone connected to a court or a house of study, it will gradually evolve into someone who speaks in the synagogue. That's already 3rd, 4th, 5th century. And later it will develop into somebody who works for the synagogue over time. Now, one other thing to realize that's very, very important during this period, and I sort of mentioned it before, is the Shtadlan thing, that the leadership of the Jewish community is involved in protecting the Jewish community. This is one of the principles I mentioned at the beginning of what the community has to do, protecting the Jews from anti-Semitism in the regular society. It was more difficult in Byzantine Palestine. It was easier in Babylonia, but of course it has been a function of the Jewish community forever. And you don't realize the extent to which you expect this to be done and benefit from its having been done. Now we then start to enter, after the Talmudic period, the Islamic conquest takes place, 638 or so, 640. The whole Jewish world virtually is conquered by the Muslims because the Christian world, Jewish communities, are not yet very important. So what I want to say is, here we have the continuation of similar institutions as Talmudic Babylonia. The exilarch becomes very powerful in the rise of the Gaonim, the rabbinic leaders who have influence not only their community. Here now, the community begins to become one. So I have to explain something. There is a whole process of the world Jewish community, as we know it, coming into existence. Yes, the world Jewish community in Second Temple times all sent money to the temple and made pilgrimage to the temple. But the world Jewish community lost, when the patriarchate was eliminated in 424, lost its formal organization. Under the Muslims, the Gaonim were able to restore a kind of world organization because they connected all the places by sending responsa, etc. But what's really interesting is that that connection broke down with the rise of local Jewish communities and the authority of local Jewish communities in the early Middle Ages. Only later, with the establishment of the Shulchan Aruch, and to a great extent in the 16th century, the standardization of the Kabbalah, the Yeri, and all those customs that hit everybody, L'chadu D'yadah, only then do we start to see, with the rise of the modern world, because that's already the time of mercantilism and all this stuff that you remember you learned about in high school, what's going on in that period is the increasing sense that the Jewish community is one community. And this notion that we have, that the Jewish community is one community, only really comes to the fore with modern communication. as opposed to the Jews of X and the Jews of Y. Yes, Jews knew something was going on, but it's only in modern times that they could rise up because there was an anti-Semitic event in such a place, a blood libel in this place, or whatever. Previous to that, all they knew was to be afraid that somebody would rise up against them. So the organized Jewish community, we know it as a world community, had in a certain sense ceased with the destruction of the temple and eventually elimination of the patriarch of Jerusalem and its at least Roman authority. But they never had authority over the East. And it comes back a little to Gonim and comes back further. Another very interesting question about Jewish community that we haven't talked about yet, which really starts to become clear in the Gaonic period, is Jewish language. Because Hebrew was no longer being spoken by too many people, and Aramaic now lost out, which was a pan-Near Eastern language, to Arabic. At that point, the Jews started to speak their own dialect. They had spoken their own dialect in Aramaic in the Talmudic period, as far as we can see. I'm not just talking about the Hebrew words. I'm talking about the whole feeling of the language. And they've seen last week's forward, an article of a debate about Ladino. Somebody thought that if Ladino has less Hebrew words than Yiddish, then Yiddish is more Jewish. So there's some kind of an argument about that. That's a strange idea, but here's the point I want to make. That the notion of Jewish languages as a part of Jewish community and Jewish identity really comes to the fore, I think, in the Judeo-Arabic material in a way that is not really there in Aramaic. Because this is a conscious decision already to write Arabic in Hebrew script. And it's not the same as just using the old Aramaic, but using it in a Jewish manner. This may be a value judgment, it may even be a wrong one, but I put it out for you. When we hit the medieval period, first of all, we have the rise of authority of the local rabbinate. The rest of it, the synagogue is the center in every Jewish community, but the charity organizations are really important. Go take a look at Goitein's medieval society. You've got there five volumes and a six-volume index, and you can find out every detail of the way the Jews of Cairo operated their community, and you can find out about the small communities all around. You have the whole complex Jewish organization that you would expect every single thing. The synagogue, the teachers, the schools, the whole thing is there. From that period on. And they deal with all the same types of issues that we deal, except that now they actually face the problem of how to deal with the Karaites, which is a sectarian group that is understood somehow to be partly in and partly out. And if you look at the debates there, much of the debate is about do they have halakhic status as Jews or not? Another of those overall issues that I introduced at the beginning. Now in the Muslim lands we have a kind of oligarchy of sages and the wealthy, people who hung out with people like the Rambam. I mean, to hang out with the Rambam would have been a very, very great privilege. But I mean to say, you know, there is a very interesting letter. There's a guy, Shmuel Desardi, who actually writes in his book, which is one of the sources of the Torah, that he had a question in halakha, and he met the Ramban in synagogue in the morning, and he asked him the question. So I mean, to hang out with these people, the Ramban, Rashi, would have been a great opportunity. But the fact of the matter is that they typify a merchant, physician, educated, Torah also class. And this class basically ruled these communities. They ruled them also in Christian countries. Partly because of the fact that one of the big problems the Jewish community faced, both in Muslim and Christian countries, was the taxes. Now, it's a little bit different because generally in the Muslim countries, the tax was a head tax. And the head tax, of course, was connected up with the Vimy protected minority status, which is not the same as the collective Jewish communal tax in Europe. So the collective Jewish communal tax in Europe drives the oligarchy of the rich to be even more important. But still, whether it's under Islam or under Christianity, as it's starting to develop from the 900s on, the community of Ashkenaz really develops. So you have a rabbinic elite connected with this economic oligarchy. They don't earn their living as rabbis, and yet they're highly involved in what you might call rabbinic issues. You have the connection in the Islamic countries with caliphs, etc., and the need for shtadlanim who handle that, and they work in the government. And then in the Christian countries, you have especially in the financial side, Jews getting closer to the government. In both places, you have independent Jewish law courts and independent systems of taxation. Now, However, a very interesting question that comes up in the Middle Ages is, what is the authority of the community? Okay, I move tomorrow around the corner from the synagogue. This synagogue. The synagogue calls me up and says, you have to pay so much taxes. Well, why should I? Maybe I don't go to the synagogue. Who are you if I have to pay taxes? Let alone who knows what. I do have to have a mezuzah in my garage. I don't have to have a mezuzah in the garage. I can't drink the water in New York. I can't drink the water in New York. I would say, who are you to tell me what to do? Why? Because we live in a post-emancipation, post-autonomy system. In the Middle Ages, however, is a really interesting question. What's the source of authority? So let me explain. In the Muslim countries, effectively the source of communal authority is the authority of the Muslims, who vested in the Jewish courts the right to try all cases and also to police all cases regarding two Jews. In the Christian countries, the issue of consent was more complex. There are two different answers that are given. One, social theory. Social contract. If I move in to your community, I automatically accept the rules set down by the people before me, whether they are rituals, whether they are rules about what does or does not constitute a kosher animal, whether they are rules pertaining to business that may have been made to protect certain people in the market, or whether or not these are taxes due. I have no choice because it already is a community to which I move into. That's the social contract theory. That's very important in medieval Jewish communal life, and I think in modern life. And the second aspect, the other theory, alternative theory in the Ashkenazic countries, is the rights come from the non-Jewish government. The non-Jewish government invited some Jews to live in this town. They became burghers of the town. They're the bosses over the Jews. This is like the famous Cheirem HaYishuv. You can't even move in if they don't let you move in. And what then happens is, they put out certain laws, you must observe them, because as in the Muslim countries, they got their authority from the non-Jewish communities. Now this is a whole new thing in the Middle Ages, where the Jewish community is now a compulsory community, compulsory because of authority, often from the non-Jewish government. You cannot escape it. You have to follow its instructions. This has certain advantages. The so-called get problem didn't exist because you had to leave the community not to give a get to your wife if the rabbis told you to give it. There was no such problem in 99.9% of the situations. However, we find many responsa in which people question the authority of the community. And I think we have to realize, therefore, that in the Middle Ages we get back the compulsory community that you got, guess where? In Israel, when you had a Jewish government. Because in biblical times, and as Medean times, you can't say, I don't want to be part of the Jewish community. What are you talking about? You're a Jew living in the land of Israel. The courts have police powers. You don't want to do it. You know, you're going to jail. Well, that type of situation comes into the medieval period, and if you examine some of the accounts of the ways in which the community exercised authority, they are amazing. And this authority was exercised on this basis. Now we hit the modern period. In the modern period, this whole sense of Jewish community starts to take a number of turns. First of all, the whole area of the so-called Sfaradim or Edot HaMizrach becomes Ottoman. For all intents and purposes, the Ottoman period had a tremendous modernizing effect. But it also was the period of stimulus for the rise of the population of Jews in Israel. The return of Jews to Israel created a community which wandered towards the original autonomy of a Jewish community, while at the same time creating a melting pot which takes place in Israel. Where I just saw an account where somebody writes to a friend in Europe and he says, I want you to come here, but if you come here you won't get a job because they only hire Sephardim to teach, and the reason is because they teach in Hebrew. And the Sephardim won't let you teach because you don't know Hebrew. So clearly this was becoming a melting pot of all kinds of places, which is why people have names like the Ari's last name was Ashkenazi. Because those names, of course, are not held by people who live in Ashkenaz. Anybody named Yushalmi is not living in Yushalayim, they wouldn't need to call them that. So we have this increase in the Ottoman period of the land of Israel becoming a melting pot. And of course, the expulsion from Spain created a greater melting pot, spreading the Sephardic traditions all over to many countries, causing, by the way, the Sephardic prayer book to become the norm for many people that weren't really Sephardic. But the key issues in the Middle East I'm talking about now, that people don't talk about, are modernization and even emancipation of Jews under the colonial powers. So Jews now start to be no longer under the compulsory system of community, and the Jews in the Middle East, like the Jews in Europe, will soon be in a situation as we have it here, where Jewish community life is voluntary. This is a radical change in the nature of the Jewish community as a disadvantage that we can't compel everybody to be in it. But I don't know if you've thought about this. For those of us who want to be in it, it has a tremendous advantage because we get to make our choice by free will to be in it. And that choice, like every other choice that we make by free will, can be important in our own development. Furthermore, in the Middle East still we have the rise up of modern schools, and then we have the eventual elimination of the communities in their location. This, of course, is something that happened both for the Middle East and for Europe, and we will come back to that in a minute in talking about the Ashkenazic areas. Now, here is a really important thing that happens in modern Judaism differently with the so-called Sephardim and Ashkenazim, and it's the rise of denominations. Because everybody knows that one of the differences between Sephardim and Ashkenazim is the lack of denominations like Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox. One can argue that sociologically and observance-wise, they exist anyhow. If you go back in history, you can see this as the fighting, or whatever you want to call it, the conflict, in virtually every single country in the Middle East between the Alliance and the Traditionalists. Now, in all of these conflicts, it essentially is a conflict between some kind of modern traditionalism and some kind of, basically, more old-fashioned traditionalism. But the point I want to make is that the avoidance of denominations is a very important difference today, because obviously what typifies Ashkenazic Jews in America, not in Israel, obviously, is this denominationalism. Now, in the Ashkenazi countries, of course, emancipation went much further. This is a sort of unfunny joke, because the emancipated Ashkenazim were soon carted off to concentration camps. But nonetheless, emancipation officially went further, and the non-emancipated Jews of the Middle East, the so-called Sephardim, were in fact in better shape in the process of modernization, even though, of course, as you all know, eventually driven out of their homes. But in any case, vis-a-vis the Ashkenazim, the European Enlightenment also had a tremendous effect. Now, what did all this stuff do? It led on the Ashkenazic side to the who is a Jew issues and the rise of the modern rabbinate. Now, the who is a Jew brings back a biblical times issue. Namely, wait a minute, we knew all along in the Middle Ages, I have a joke about who is a Jew, I said there are two groups of people who always know who a Jew is. They are the El Al security guards and the security guard at the campus of the Hebrew University campus. All these people know exactly who is a Jew. They don't even have to tell from miles away. But the fact is that the return of the who is a Jew problem in modern times is to some extent a major part within the Jewish community, in which we now have not only overlapping Jewish communities in terms of affiliation, but even of Jewish status. And there is nobody who wants to deny the higher numbers to the federal government when we want to lobby for Israel. And that's why we all accept collectively the 6 million number, even though the problem, probably the number of Jews that we consider Jews is more like 4.5 million. But we're not interested in that. We don't want to know about it. Now, the modern rabbinate is a key issue, because I now want to go back and simply ask what's happened now. Once the Jewish community relocated to Israel and the United States and France as well, we have to remember that's a very big community. Eventually what has happened is that many things have happened to virtually everybody, and let me go over these things. Number one, we have the rise of modern education. No matter what anybody said, by the time we got finished, the notion that you have a modern education is true of almost everybody. In fact, many so-called right-wing elements are having a modern education. A minimal secular education, which allows you to function, but the notion of not knowing how to read English and all this, it's virtually non-existent. So this creates the modern educational institutions. Another part of the institutions of modern Judaism is the rise of the modern yeshiva and or rabbinical seminary, which are full-scale imitations of universities in terms of their size and the way they operate and their finances, all something which began in the Ashkenazi countries in the 1800s and have now become the norm in the Jewish community. The rabbi, who during the Middle Ages was still unpaid, they began to be paid after the Shulchan Aruch. The rabbinate became professionalized from the Ottoman period on, it became completely professionalized in the Western countries because of the fact that the now non-compulsory Jewish community pay the rabbis. I'm, by the way, not talking about burial. It's a whole subject, a very complex subject. But charity in modern times gradually moved, beginning with charities aimed at raising money from Israel, to a massive organized operation, which is on a level never known before within the Jewish community, to sponsor and pay for all types of massive things, many of which, by the way, are not charity. If you build a Jewish community center, so that our children can play ball and go to, I live in a place where there is none, so I don't even know very much about what they do there. But anyhow, right, if you build this Jewish community center, this may not be charity. It may even not be charity to build a new synagogue sometimes. When you have a building that functions and the people can just as well pray there and everybody can do everything they want, that's not charity. However, the massive efforts to help the poor, to help Jews living in other countries, this is all a result of what modernization gave to the Jewish community. Yes, they used to go out and collect money for Israel throughout history. The notion, however, that a Jew would collect money in Turkey to send that money to Jews, poor Jews living in the Ukraine, is because of the modernization / globalization, which has changed the Jewish community in an unbelievable way. The rise of federations and community charity, okay. Support of Israel. This is something brand new, which has, of course, hit the entire community. It's the idea is not only financial, but political support. The community then took on this obligation. The community reorganized itself for this purpose. And I would argue that these two purposes, charity and the support of Israel, this is basically the philanthropic argument for the Jewish communal organization, underlies the unity of the Jewish community in America. And of course, we are all part of this process. Even though we may disagree greatly with many of our fellow Jews, this unifies us. And I always enjoy seeing the picture. Every Hanukkah, there is a group of rabbis, mostly Aguda rabbis, who go to Washington, but they bring some satmar along. And these are all the old-fashioned Hasidic rabbis. And they come there, and they give a speech to the president, and they present them with a menorah. And the speech is all about support for Israel, and the three or four satmar guys have to stand there with their mouth closed, because the bottom line is that the Jewish community's purpose in America, among its purposes, the whole communal organization, from left to right, is to support Israel in a whole variety of ways. Now, when we come, therefore, to America, we have to raise, and this is the last subject which I want to address, some very particular issues now. Given the concepts that I laid before you at the beginning, and the history of these institutional frameworks within which we operate, there are many questions that have to be asked about America. First of all, from our point of view, we have to remember that America saw an almost defeat of orthodoxy and its revival. Now, orthodoxy, in the way in which it's usually termed, refers fundamentally to a variety of forms of Jewish practice that opposed the reform of Judaism and other such movements, and came from Europe to America, followed as they were by a whole bunch of new populations, which include Hasidim, who really came here only after World War II, they were very small numbers. The Hasidim that were here before don't look like the ones that we know now. Sephardim, despite the fact that Sephardim, in quotes, were here in the revolutionary period and started American Judaism. But the fact is that that wasn't really the producer of our community as we know it. Israelis and Russians. And this means to say that we have in America a very non-homogeneous Jewish population. So clearly this proves my point when we say the Jewish community and we say which one. Well, the Russians are very, very different in their Jewish community than, say, the American Reform. So when we say this, we are talking about a community of interlocking communities. Now, in my view, the whole American Jewish community is in the process of a change. And then what is emerging now is that the old Holy Trinity of Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is gone. First, it was broken by the rise of Reconstructionism. But in fact, what I think is happening now is that we are developing a two-group system. There's something which we will loosely call conservative / reform / reconstructionist. And then there's another thing called orthodoxy, which is itself a pluralism. Now this has the advantage and disadvantage of highlighting what I've said about a community of communities. Because if we will take a look at any one of these groups, about ourselves, we're usually not self-reflective enough. But if you'll take a look at the non-Orthodox community, you'll realize that the analogy between the various Reformed, Conservative, and Reconstructionist rabbinical seminaries to the various yeshivot and Orthodox rabbinical seminaries, ranging from Chovah Beit Torah to Torah V'Yira of Satmar, that this whole breadth, this tremendous breadth, typifies both groups. And therefore, anyone who wants to understand the American Jewish community will not only have the baggage that came from the past that we discussed so far, but will have the new feature of these two groups replacing the old three groups, and this will be in contrast to Israel, in which the community of communities is very, very differently defined because of a number of distinctions. The Ashkenazic-Sephardic distinction, which in Israel means different things than it means here. It's not about Sidurim and what synagogue you go to, not even and who you're going to marry. It's all about all kinds of other political issues and other things and social issues. It's a different issue with all of the improvements that have been made. And then we also have to realize that in Israel, of course, the sort of pluralism of orthodoxy, it doesn't work the way it does here. Because the various orthodox groups in Israel are severely defined as so-called Datiim and Haredim. Haredim, it's funny, used to be the name of the OU. They used to call themselves in Hebrew, right? Igud HaKehilot HaHaredios BaAmerika. It just used to be a word for orthodox, because it means God-fearing. But in any case, today, in Israel, the divisions are much greater. But we seem to have a pluralism of orthodoxy that works on a rainbow or a scale. And it goes from one side of the scale to the other side of the scale, and we should therefore realize that the other groups are in a similar pluralism. By the way, population-wise, the Orthodox percent of the population is growing, and one has to expect that it's going to grow immensely in the future, and it will grow on the right more than on the middle or the left of the Orthodox community. But one reason I'm mentioning this is because the changes that are going on in front of us about the actual population of our American Jewish community, which are really big changes, are going to mean that we are going to have to reevaluate some matters pertaining to our community. I think it's likely that the philanthropy and Israel support will remain the central pillar because it is what enables this, what I'm calling the conservative reform reconstructionist group to interact with the variety of Orthodox groups. Because it becomes the kind of replacement for the face-to-face theological questions which we don't agree upon regarding the very nature of the community, let alone the specifics of Jewish law, etc. And therefore, these new factors, which are changing the nature of the American Jewish community, are going to require a reevaluation of a lot of things. So let me mention a number of things that will hit us in the Orthodox community as to this type of reevaluation. Number one, the purpose of ethnicity. Among the Ashkenazim, ethnicity has almost died as an organizer of the Jewish community. Running two small synagogues can barely get a minyan in some place in Maine, and two cemeteries based on whether somebody comes from White Russia, known as Lithuania, or comes from Poland, known as Galicia, of course makes absolutely no sense. This is true despite the fact that there used to be many more differences like the prayer books. But the fact is that Ashkenazim have moved away from this, as everybody all knows, especially among the non-Orthodox. The question is your kid marrying a Jew in that group? Not, is your kid marrying a person from Hungary, or Galicia, or whatever else, whatever other kind of things. So it means that ethnicity is going to have to be reevaluated, especially among the so-called Sephardim, because ethnicity or sub-ethnicity, Tehrani and Mashadi Iranian, for example, let alone Shirazi and other things. I mean, a guy who doesn't want his kid to marry somebody because they come from this town and that town. And the bottom line is that this purpose of ethnicity is going to have to be reevaluated. If ethnicity is going to be a way of keeping Jews Jewish and increasing Torah and mitzvot, then it belongs. If it's going to be an unethical form of exclusivity, then it isn't going to belong. Then there is vertical versus horizontal integration within Orthodoxy. By this I mean the following. Should a modern Orthodox Lubavitcher, you all know these guys, they have knitted kippot, very short beards, work in the computer business, should they be socializing and talking to modern Orthodox Ashkenazim and Sephardim? Or should they be socializing with right-wing Lubavitchers who wear long coats all day? Now, the question can be then imposed on other communities. Should Jews, let us say for the sake of argument, from Afghanistan, attempt to have themselves socialized only with Afghani Jews, or will this kind of horizontal integration, by which I mean to say that groups will associate and work with other groups that are more like them? This can be imposed on virtually every group of Jews, and affects all types of questions regarding the major organizations of Orthodoxy. Who affiliates with what and how and why? And the question that we face is, will this continue to be by some form of ethnicity? The Russians have to have their own unit in the UJA? Or should Russian businessmen, now they're Americans, they speak English, be hanging around with, you know, three-generation American businessmen? So is ethnicity something we want? And should it continue, should we have people integrating only within their ethnic group? Or should they begin to integrate across the ideological schemes of Orthodoxy? Then we have the real question of to what extent will we allow the ideological divides of Orthodoxy to divide Orthodoxy in the manner that they divide Orthodoxy in Israel. And will the community stand up to this and say that we have a general Jewish community, we have an Orthodox community, we know we have sub-communities, but we don't want to allow these sub-communities to enter into forms of conflict with one another, such as go on elsewhere. Now what I would submit to you is that all these questions, of which there are also all kind of additional ones, what should be the role of rabbis in the current Orthodox Jewish community, which is highly educated, what types of roles should be done by individual synagogues, what should be done by organizations as the community expands, in communities, by which I mean to say locales, to what extent should groups get together to do things together that shouldn't be done. Of course, we've all done this with school and Jewish education. Everybody knows you can't run Jewish education anymore out of your synagogue the way it used to be done. We all know you have to do this together with other Jews in the locale or in a similar style of education that you're interested in. But over time, the question is going to be, how do we take all of the aspects we talked about of community, whether it's relating to the non-Jews, whether it's fighting anti-Semitism, relating to other Jews, every single one of these issues is going to have to be reevaluated by an American Jewish community that has faced major, major changes, and in which, especially in our part of the community, there is immense growth that has already taken place, and immense growth that is taking place. And what I would submit to you is that some of the conceptual and historical issues that I mentioned are the ones that will have to mold these decisions in the future, because otherwise what we will be simply doing is making some convenient social decisions who we want to hang out with. And that is not the way to guarantee the future of Judaism in this country, in which the Jewish community has more freedom and autonomy than in any other place, but which I think we all know provides challenges to the interlocking communities that we are part of that really were not posed before. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shiflin. Dr. Shiflin has kindly agreed to take some questions from the audience if you'd like. Just signify by raising your hand. We'll do it in an orderly manner, in a communal way.
Yes, sir.
The last part there suggested that there's some sort of active mechanism for achieving this. And it always seemed to me that there's sort of this invisible hand that.
Well, this is really interesting because I'm not sure we're not asking the question of, you know, I call Tafoy by reshooting to not, whether there's free will in Judaism or something. Let me answer this question. First of all, the gentleman asked, for those of you who didn't hear the question, whether there's an invisible hand that we can really make determinations. The first thing I want to say is that we very often make determinations in our personal lives about small things, which fit into these overall questions. And you don't realize often how much your own actions in some situation, it's true it's a small situation, but collectively it's a big deal. But here's what I want to say about this. There's a lot of communal planning that goes on. A lot of it is incompetent and meaningless, and some of it is not. Some of it is very meaningful. And sometimes there are very significant decisions that have to be made. And you can see, I want to give you a small example. There is about to open, we had this idea that we should build an A roof for NYU, for the students. There's a lot of problem getting into your dorm. You need IDs and all this kind of thing, and all kinds of arrangements, but we wanted to go to Eruv. But we discovered that YU wanted an Eruv for Stern College. Then we discovered that there was an Orthodox shul in the area that was trying to take the lead of this. Well, these people all got together, and they wanted to get money, so they're going around to non-Orthodox groups. Now, somebody made a tactical decision that they should go to these people with a message of why they should contribute to this Eruv. Well, you know what? Not only did it work, but it sowed a lot of good feeling in the lower Manhattan community. The Eruv isn't open yet. Nobody should get the wrong idea. The Eruv is actually soon to open. It's really close to done. Just in time to graduate, right? So anyhow, right? Okay. However, this is what I want to say about this. There is a decision being made by a few people about how to approach a community, and what do you think community means, and how do you explain, we could have thrown the whole question of Eruv into the discussion here, because in a certain sense it makes a symbolic community under my halakhic section, but somebody made a decision which made a lot of good feeling for a lot of people, and it's a small decision and a small act. Let me also mention to you that I think on the wider communal level, that the communal leaders make a lot of decisions about issues like this that altogether do influence the nature of how our community will be. But of course you're right, no one of us controls this. You can't go out of here and say, okay, great, we decided we're doing that. It isn't going to work. And of course, people always do what they want to do. But I think a lot of things can be done and do matter. And ultimately, I also think the community is wise, and many correct decisions have been made so far. And I think correct decisions will be made in the future. But they may be somewhat different than decisions that were appropriate now. Other questions? Yes?
What do you think are the main reasons for the shift to the right?
What do I think of the main? Well, you know, Sam Harman wrote this book, Sliding to the Right. I want to say one thing. Much of the shift to the right, as we call it, orthodoxy, results from demography. These all these Satmar families with 24 kids. And as you go, a lot of this is appearance, what looks like the shift to the right, much of it is demography. Now, once we get beyond demography, we have to separate several things. There's a part of the shift to the right that means we did used to do this right, and now we're doing it right. An example is we used to eat things that we now know contain percentages of non-kosher ingredients beyond anybody's opinion of what's kosher. We now know that, so we're not eating those things. Now, even if one would disagree with this is an attempt just to do what we are supposed to do. Then there are other aspects, like somebody announcing that no one should eat strawberries at all, that only a mashkiach can check strawberries for bugs, but you can't do it in your house. Now, this seems to me to be an example of the kind of egregious case of someone coming over the new halakha, substituting with a real halakha, and claiming that we all have to observe this halakha and cannot buy strawberries and check them for bugs ourselves, which I don't really know why we can't. So the point I'm making is that type of thing, when we want to understand many of these developments, we must understand that America in general is going through a religious move to the right. Who ever saw on American television candidates being asked not to go to church? What do you really believe? Who ever saw such a thing? Forget about abortion, yes, abortion, no. The types of personal questions that are being asked of candidates, and the fact of the matter is that America is going through a kind of a religious revival. For us, it can be in some ways good, but we have to be careful that we don't fall into the trap of forms of fanaticism. Let me mention a certain very well-known bookseller, where this book, which I forgot, came out, which is supposed to be about laws of modesty, but goes into whether a woman can have a button here, or a button here, or a button here. It discusses what type of shape everyone's underwear should be. The guy obviously spent his whole life in women's clothing stores, and this particular person handed me a copy of this book and said, look at this, he said, they want to again drive everyone away from Judaism. The problem of a lot of these things is, if we again create an orthodoxy that cannot be lived by a person who's part of the real world, and which requires that people do all types of things that appear to be fanatical, and separates them from the world, then, let me give you just a small example. Let's say someone were to eliminate Rav Moshe Feinstein's leniencies about men and women being alone, saying there's a window, or this, that, and the other thing, right? So now suddenly it would be completely impossible for a Jew to be in any job in which a male and female would ever be alone. This means that three-quarters of us would have to leave our occupations and move to the Pale of Settlement. Now, the point is,
in case you don't know, that's where the Jews had to live in Russian Poland, right?
So now, the point is, this type of disconnection, let's say somebody would adopt halakhic stance that a Jew cannot be a doctor. Let's say somebody would say, lo tachanein means that you can't treat a sick non-Jew. This types of move to the right, if in fact adopted across the Jewish community, would again mean that you can't be part of society and be an observant Jew. And so this would undo. So this is the problem. We have to distinguish between what it is. And these are very important decisions. Are we improving our observance? Are we becoming better people? Or are we lapsing into a form of fanaticism? Now, one other factor besides the American move to the right, which is illustrative of this particular business with strawberries. Luckily, I don't eat strawberries. I don't care what they do. But anyway. But the point is, this is part of the scientificization, I made up that word, of orthodoxy. Meaning the very people who don't want to go to college now say, well, no, we have to look with microscopes. And exactness that never existed before. It's like saying Shabbat is over at 7:21, but it wasn't over at 7:20. It's impossible that our forefathers could have ever known the difference between 7:20 and 7:21. So the point that I'm making is this scientificization, over-specification of Judaism, is part of the importation of the secular science into the world of Jewish law, which is another thing going on. So we always have to make sure, we have to keep our eye on the ball. Is something, let's get rid of this word move to the right, which always sounds bad. Is something making us a better Jew? Is it making us a better Jew to do something? Or is it just some form of fetishism or fanaticism? And making ourselves better Jews would have to be not only in these ritual matters, but let's see how many people are willing to be fanatical about the way they talk to other people, the way they treat members of their family or other people outside their family, about business ethics. If you're willing to be fanatical about that, then when you're fanatical about some of these other things, people say this person is truly tzaddik, and it's not, it won't bother us. But that's, I think, we have to be very careful about distinguishing those things. So, but I got to tell you, the externals of the move to the right, the demography is a big, big factor. And as people have a large group of people, they will determine decisions for the community in a certain way. Okay, sir.
First of all, given the fact that we live in democracy and let people do whatever they want, and the growth of the Orthodox community, and the fact that I think that the synagogue is less of a factor in organizing life than the yeshiva is in the Orthodox community.
Yeah, that's correct, Father.
And also with the kind of familiarization, making family control over some of the institutions, people who want to separate themselves or want to achieve will often go out of faith.
Okay, yeah.
So you're getting, a splinter as well.
Okay, good. Let me comment about this so far.
It's not control.
Right. Let me comment about this so far. First of all, the experience of big philanthropists making all the decisions rather than the community is not working. And those philanthropists are discovering it one by one. And I think that you're going to soon see a return to more communal decisions except by those people who simply cannot suffer the idea that anybody does anything other than that. But a lot of that money's wasted. And it's very sad. And a lot of those philanthropists, somebody just mentioned to me, one of them said he told him that he knows that much of his money was wasted. It bothers him greatly. People try things that do not have a chance of success and don't ask others who know or friends of theirs. So this tendency towards individualization and get away from community as a solution is, I think, not going to be there in the future. Simply because it doesn't work. It simply isn't possible for you to plan a major communal undertaking, no matter how much money you have, without talking to others. It just doesn't go. Now, the other aspect of this that I want to say is that as to the decline of the synagogue as a major factor when compared to the schools and yeshivas, there's no question there's been tremendous growth in the schools and yeshivas. I think if we look at truly religious Jews, we're going to see two patterns vis-a-vis the shul. There are the people who live in places where you can go one time to this place and another time to that place, and third, and there's no connection to a synagogue or a rabbi. And then there are the others, where they still have a traditional setup. There may be six minyanim in the shul, but they go into this place. And this person is their rabbi, and these are their fellow members, and these are the people with whom they live their lives, and these are the people who are going to make the minyan when, God forbid, they have to say kaddish. And I think both of these patterns exist in the Orthodox community today, in the New York area. In the smaller communities, there's only one option, is the other option. And I think that this is part of the centripetal force, if you want to call it, of modern America, but it's also part of the shift of Jewish education from being the number two or three priority to being, for most of us, for our children, the number one. And so, you're right about what you're saying, and the more effort we put into education, the more we have to worry about that. The trick there is to make sure that people understand why the synagogue has been so important to us, and in strengthening the school, they don't lose their time with the synagogue. But I agree with you that there's some people who have, especially in these kind of over-urbanized Jewish areas, where it's possible to never go to the same synagogue twice. Other questions from other parts of the building? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks again, Dr. Shiffman. You've given us a lot of food for thought.